Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
I've gotten in some pretty good arguments with other reenactors because, and reenactors can take this for what it's worth, and I'm going to say it because this is my passion and I live for the field kitchen, is if you're going to do it, you strive for 100%. And we know, because we call ourselves living historians, and the reason I say living historians instead of using the word reenactor, a reenactor to some degree, and it's a large group of them, will only take their impression only so far, and that's where it stops. They don't do research every day like we do. They only live from one reenactment to another one, where we live at 365 days a year. We're constantly researching photos, manuals, videos from World War II. We talk to the veterans that were cooks in World War II. We get their pictures, their stories. We read anything that we can get on the mess halls and the supplies for the food. And we make our own labels. We make our, a lot of the stuff we make ourselves. And so to me, we strive for 100% knowing that we never probably will get to an exact 100%, but we're always striving, because when you stop striving for 100%, you start going backwards.
Welcome everybody to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And sadly, that was a clip from episode 46 featuring Brian Cookie Vineyard. He was a member of the Tri-State Living History Association who specialized in authentic, error-correct field kitchens. But I think one Jeff Copsetta would be more poignant to talk a little more about that. How you doing, Jeff?
Yeah, good. It's tough to start what's going to be a great episode that way, but I'm glad that we got to do it. Yeah, Byron was, or affectionately known as Cookie, was just, what an incredible guy. I'm so glad that you got to travel to meet him. I know his son very well. His son is a really good friend of mine, and his son is a great living historian in his own right. Been in the museum field for a while and marketing, and that guy, he's jumped into Normandy. I want to say for the 65th, I'm not exactly sure. It's been some time now, probably 10 or so years. But his son Brandon's just like I said, a real good buddy of mine. And when I heard that his dad had finally had passed, was, you know, we kind of saw it coming. It was not like a shocker. I talked to Brandon right before Christmas, and he said, you know, it's within weeks. So that's tough. You know, yeah. Anytime you lose somebody like that, lose a parent, and the living history world, really, it's a big hole, because Cookie would set up one incredibly complete field kitchen, every ingredient, everything authentic for everything that he would cook. And he'd set up, you know, up there in Illinois. He brought his camp down to Texas a couple times for us. I mean, just an incredible, just what a production. And it just lends so much more realism. You know, those things that we strive for, you could, your uniform can be great, everything, you know, everything, you know, and then you go and get a cheeseburger from somewhere.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's not the same, but when you were in a chow line and you're handed a, you know, a tray or a canteen cup and a spoon, and you go through and they slop it on there,
yep,
and you shovel it down, and then you're dumping in the water and the hot water and the soap, scrubbing it out, hanging it up. You know, I mean, it was a regular field kitchen. Like, we were just pulled off the line, you know, and it's just an incredible guy. I'm just so happy I got to meet him and learn from him. And Don, I'm so happy that you got to do the same, and we can immortalize him here on our podcast.
And in that interview, he took great pride in the fact that they were one of the few outfits that didn't upgrade their field stoves to propane. He still used gasoline, and he took great pride in that. But what we're going to do, we're going to make this a two-part episode for the download, not on YouTube, but download. So once you guys listen to this fantastic, normal episode of part one, part two, because Byron's original interview was a part of a two-part episode, meaning we had two guests on that. And so what I've done is isolated his full interview. And so when you go on your podcast app, you'll see the episode for tonight, episode 106, part one and part two. that full interview with Byron will be part two. And so please enjoy that interview and give him a little bit of remembrance. But we're happy to announce on lighter notes, one Henry Sludge went out of his way like he always does. The book is a fantastic guest. And so Henry, if you wouldn't mind introducing to our friends on YouTube and
everybody
and everywhere else.
Glad to be here. I want to welcome our guest tonight. It's Paul Woodedge of World War II TV, a very good friend of mine. Paul is a prolific YouTuber. He is a battlefield guide. He's a historian. He's an author, and he lives in Normandy, just a short drive from the D-Day beaches. And I've got to say, I've watched many episodes of World War II TV, in addition to the one that I was honored to be a guest on. But Paul, I love what you are doing for the, as you've got a word out there that I love to use now, the historiography of World War II. And I love what you do. I mean, you get granular with these things. You had these guests on Saul David and John McManus, Brian Dmitrovich, you know, you've got some fantastic content, and it's something I never get tired of watching. And I'm always talking it up to these guys, and I'm just super excited to have you here on What's the Scuttlebutt.
Well, cheers. That's a pretty cool introduction. That was good. Yeah, no, I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you for taking your time and coming out.
No problem at all.
So you, World War II TV, did that start for you, Paul, when COVID shut everything down? I mean, it seems like I've heard you say that.
Yeah. No, I was, I've been living in Normandy for 20 years, and I'm a guide. My other half is a guide. All my mates here are battlefield guides, and COVID just ripped everything out of the industry. Sure. We knew that our industry was very dependent on American visitors, but we didn't know how important it was until they stopped coming. And we just had nothing to do. And broadly speaking, there's sort of two groups of people I know here in Normandy, those that have just kind of gone kind of hibernated and just try to do something else, and you know, maybe taken a second job or go back to something I did years ago, and others who've carried on doing something else. They've been writing or speaking or lecturing. And in my case, I thought, okay, I know these people, these historians, what can I do? And I started with a live show on June the 6th. That was 2020. So I did a 17-hour live stream. I just sat here on my computer for 17 hours with just one or two pee breaks. Basically, historians dialed in every now and then, and I had people out with their phones taking footage from the beaches, and it was really ragged and really rough around the edges. And you know, we lost the last few hours of it because YouTube stopped recording it.
Really?
I didn't know YouTube stopped after 12 hours or something. They do anyway.
Well,
I wonder what
it was fantastic.
I wonder what the world record is for longest live stream.
Well, if it's more than I did, that I'm never going to do it again. I mean, that's one of the things I would. I'm not going to try that again. It was really great, but towards the end, I was just, I don't know. I had a couple of guests on, and I was using friends at the end. I mean, it was most friends all the time, but I don't know what I was talking about the last hour or so. I had people say, "You were just on," you know, all over the place. And, well, okay, fine, but it was an experience, and then I just put it into okay, let's do this on a more, you know, kind of evening by evening basis. And I get people telling me, "Oh, you planned it really well, this whole thing." I didn't plan anything. Everything was accidental. Everything was one thing led to something else.
And, very spontaneous.
Yeah. Now it feels like it's got a bit more planning, and now I plan. But when I started a year and a half ago, I've done over 400 live streams. So I'm doing pretty much three out of every 4 days, I'm doing something.
How do you keep your content fresh? I mean, because I mean, we do this once a week. I have another podcast, so I'm doing two podcasts twice a week. I mean, once a week, different content though. Obviously, there's a lot of World War II stuff, but one's knowledge base is only so big. And when you're doing three of them a week, unless you're having guests on who do, you know, who have expansive knowledge in other areas, how do you not burn through your content so quick?
Well, that's, you said it yourself. I bring people on who know their subject, and people say, "Oh, you know," people call me Woody. You know a lot, Woody. I said, "Well, I know a bit. I know a bit about a lot of things, and I'm able to kind of host it and pretend, get away with pretending I know a lot. But I just bring, if I can, it sounds arrogant, the best of the best on. So if I'm tackling Eastern Front Week, for example, so, you know, I bring on authors who have done 5, 6, 7 books each. And I think, well, I can't get better than that. And it started off because I was lucky enough to have a few people that I knew for years. People like John McManus, you mentioned there, Alex Kershaw, James Holland, the British author. I'd known those guys for years. So I went with mates first. And I also went with Normandy first, my backyard, literally, as you said, that I'm 15 minutes drive from Omaha Beach. And then I broadened sideways into Eastern Front, Pacific, things like that as well. And I get people saying, are you going to run out of ideas to do? Just to yesterday now, I was sitting on my Word document, putting up ideas. Mm-hmm. And for just one of my theme weeks, because I try and break things down into sort of 4 or 5 shows in a theme, I had 20 ideas for 1 week. Now, few of them won't happen. And that's, I must be thinking sort of 6 months, 9 months ahead now. So, I mean, I've got so many ideas. And each thing leads to something else. That's the thing.
The thing I've got to say, I mean, you said it yourself, Woody, you're an ETO guy. You live in Normandy. That's your bread and butter. But when you step out of that box to go, okay, now I'm going to go PTO. I mean, the things that you're doing, I mean, the shows with, was it Michael Veach with Milne Bay and Carl James, Philip Bradley, the D-Day show in New Guinea. I mean, love the show on Rabaul, also with Philip Bradley.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just sitting there going, God, yes, thank you. Please give me another show like this. I mean, you're taking it. We've all seen the old tired archival footage many times, but you're taking it layers below that and getting granular with it, with these authors who, as you say, really know their stuff. And I mean, I think it's just driving a whole new direction for World War II for the consumption of this subject.
Well, thank you. I mean, the thing is, it's not getting massive viewing numbers. I mean, it's still fairly early days with how YouTube works. But, you know, I'm talking about a subject for 2 hours. I mean, the show I did earlier today was about armored development in the Spanish Civil War. So I actually kind of broke my own rule and I talked about something non-World War II, but the whole point was it was about what lessons were learned.
Right.
And Pete, the guest, came on, and so we went through what was the Spanish Civil War, how was it fought, then a whole bit about the battle and, you know, tanks going into a city and anti-tank gun fire, blah, blah, blah. And the last bit was the breakdown of what did each country learn from this. How did the Soviets take this and move it forward? The Germans, we even looked at what the Japanese army military had done. They weren't in participating, but they had people reading reports. So only a certain type of person will go for 2 hours. I was interesting, you know, your introduction there to your friend who you lost living history. You know, you could spend, if you want, 3 hours looking at what kind of spoons were issued in 1941 and what kind of spoons were issued in 1944 and find out the ratio of which pattern was what. Some people won't care, but some will. But it's whether or not the will who do care is a big enough audience, if you like, to generate things. So, you know, I know full well, because YouTube tells me that I should be doing 10-minute videos with animations and explosions and covering everything. And it's just not what I want to do. I want to do deep dives. But it means you leave a few people behind because you're going deeper than they want to go.
Well, two things. One, early on in this podcast, I did an hour and a half long episode on the M1 helmet. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And two, when it comes to YouTube, there's just so much other competition, quote unquote, even if it's not just to get likes. People watch your video who never subscribe to your channel. It's insane because, you know, we struggle with that too. And, you know, not to go off, but to put in perspective, during COVID, I got on TikTok to see what my 13-year-old daughter was up to. And then I started posting videos. I've been on TikTok for a year and a half. I got 10,000 viewers, subscribers. I've been on YouTube forever and we're struggling to get to 1,000. So, I mean, I completely understand. It's just so weird. And off the air, I'll give you another option that you can actually copy your YouTube links to put up on a very similar website that actually we get more views on. It's called the Utah Gun Exchange or YouTube. And basically they launched when YouTube demonetized videos about firearms. And so they launched it. And so basically every time I post a video on YouTube, I'll copy the link, go to that website, and it'll import it automatically with all the same hashtags. And I actually get more views over there because that demographic's more into what we talk about. And so that's always an option too.
Mm.
But going back to what you're saying real quick, not to go too far back, you doing your first episode, you said you're doing a live stream and every once in a while a mate would call in or someone would go out. I don't think people realize how hard it is to sit in a room by yourself and maintain a conversation while you're waiting for your mates to call in or waiting for them to set up that live stream. I did radio for 6 years, and when I first started this podcast, I would only do an episode when I had a guest to talk to, because it is so hard to sit in a room by yourself, carry on a conversation like you're schizophrenic with yourself, and make it sound like to the listening audience that you're talking to them, which is why I have a Jeff and a Henry, because it's just easier to do a show, and they have a lot more knowledge than I do. And so for you to do that straight out the gate as your first one, and be able to do the traffic copying while waiting for people to come in, that's a huge testament to you and your knowledge base.
Well, it's also because I still call myself a battlefield guide. I'm kind of hoping I won't have to go back into doing that except when I want to. But as a battlefield guide, you know, you're there in front of your audience for 9 hours. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know,
right.
You've got to keep their attention for all that time. Sure, you're driving during the course of it and you're stopping for lunch, but you've got to keep them interested, and you've got to keep a variety of people interested, because people think if you're a battlefield tour guide, every family you get is someone like Henry, you know, who's retracing their family's footsteps, who they think this is the most incredible thing they've ever done. And there's a lot of that, but a lot of people are just taking it off a list. They're just...
Sure.
They've done Rome, and they've done that. What they're in Venice and Leaning Tower of Pisa, and now they're doing Normandy. Normandy particularly is the worst place, the worst battlefield in the world for people who are just ticking it off a list. And that's me being kind of negative and cynical. And they are the people who pay our wages, because we get 1.5 million people come to Normandy a year.
Why do you think that is, Woody? I mean, what, like, because you can't just drive through. Oh, there, they came ashore there. Boom, now we've done it. Let's go on to Paris or whatever. Is it just... Like, I watched the show where you had one of your people out driving around. You went to some different churches. You had somebody who'd been in an armor unit. Sorry, but I can't remember exactly which show it was. But, I mean, I was just like, this is incredible, of the level of detail that you're going into. But to my question, though, why do you think Normandy is, like, the worst battlefield for the people who just want to do a quick check the box?
Because it's the one people can name, isn't it? You know, you go into a street in London, Sydney, Milwaukee, whatever, and say, name a battle from history. If they've got any battle in their head, yep. D-Day is going to be one of them. Gettysburg, maybe, Iwo Jima, you know, and you start, you know, you said that you're very nice to compliment on shows like Milne Bay, and we did one on the Romanian and the SS fighting in the streets under Odessa. It's fairly niche stuff, but D-Day, everyone, I mean, D-Day has become a word in our language. You know, you'll read in the newspaper, a politician is facing their D-Day, you know, that people will make storming the beaches analogies. It's just part of our
frame. It's become its own brand.
Yeah. And of course, we have to acknowledge the incredible power of Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, and the imagery of things like Bill Clinton for the 50th walking down the beach, putting the stones there, which was set up, by the way, those stones were set there for him to find, and he put them in a cross shape. And then, and Reagan's speech the 10 years before, the 40th, was important as well. Which brings it, you know, when you talk about historiography, we can now look at the historiography of visits to Normandy. We've got enough back history. We can look at how people were visiting 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and how they're visiting now, and look at the changes. So Normandy is always going to be that kind of place, whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kind of have a thought or an idea of what you're going to say, but prior to COVID hitting and basically knocking the wind out of the sails of the battlefield guide industry, I probably would say the answer is going to be yes, but I'll let you answer. In your view, just probably because it happened on those shores, do you think the average Norman counterpart to American has more knowledge and interest in history of World War II, or are they just kind of over it because it's always been there in the background?
Oh, they definitely have the interest, because you can't live here without going past a cemetery on your way to work, or past a tank or a monument. I mean, we haven't even counted the monuments here in Normandy, but it's thousands, you know. I mean, it's right. I drive past a Churchill, a Hetzer, and a Sherman every time and a Hellcat every time I go to do my shopping. So that's just how it is here. That isn't to say that everybody is mad keen interested in it. People know about it, but don't really care. Not, and that doesn't mean they don't care about the loss. You know, they'll come out once a year and do their ceremony, but it's not. They don't live and breathe it.
Sure.
But you know, they just know about it here. That's just how it is.
Back to the when you got started on your World War II TV, up to now, are you just a one man crew, or do you got a producer or someone help you booking people, or are you just doing it all on your own?
Oh me. Yeah.
To do three shows a week, that's tremendous.
It's normally five a week, sometimes six.
Wow.
Occasionally seven. And I always do them live because I'm lazy and live means no editing, because you guys know, you get stuck in editing hell.
Oh yeah.
Live is good because it stands and falls. When I press end stream, my only little job to do 10 minutes later is add the little thumbnails to the end of the video and check and monetize it, check all that kind of thing. But it's done. You know, occasionally I have a guest who doesn't want to go live and I record it.
Yeah.
And then I put it up, but it takes me four or five times longer that way.
And I get that
because I start editing out the errs and slicking, making it a bit slicker. And it also loses something. I've got a community now who love jumping in and making comments and saying, ask the historian this, because they've got access to the people.
And you involve that as you're watching the show. I mean, so and so, is asking the question about. I mean, that's a constant thing I see you doing.
Yeah, and it's getting to the point where it's starting to get a bit unwieldy now. As I last 6 weeks, 2 months or so, I saw an increase in viewers, which is great, and I've been waiting for it, and it's going up now. But it's just meaning that the sidebar can get a little bit unruly, because I'm hosting, so I'm thinking about what I'm saying next and what I'm going to ask next. I'm often moving the PowerPoint images on as well and loading up video, and I'm answering questions coming in and getting rid of people, the bots and things like that that join.
I hate to say this, but you're getting to the point where you're going to need a producer. It's going to happen sooner or later. The bots are the worst. The few times we've had people come in our live stream, it's just insanity, just nonsense they're posting. You got to try to do all the things you're doing, the traffic cop, and to maintain the conversation while deleting obscenities out of the chat. It's a lot of work. And
I expect I will need to find someone, and that will be a real hurdle for me, because it's not... Control freak sounds like I'm some really weird person. I'm not. I just like knowing how I do things.
Sure.
I'm in France. And Mag, my other half, who's also a tour guide, she says I could apply because I've got a business for someone to help with the video editing side of things and the social media and put things up on Instagram or whatever. But I'd have to watch everything they do, because I would say, well, I'm doing a show about Peleliu. Find me four Peleliu images. But I'd have to check that they find me four Peleliu images, not two Peleliu ones, and one for me regime, and one because they don't know how to discern those things there. And they would spell armor the American way when I wanted it spelled the British way, or whatever it would be. So I'd end up doing all the work anyway. I'd end up checking everything. So I might as well do it myself.
And you're talking about, using your skills as a battlefield guide to maintain that consistent information flow. That's kind of the reasons why early on I would interview reenactors and living historians, because living historians more than reenactors, because living historians, they set up their displays. And Jeff and I have often joke around that a living history event is kind of like a tech show or a car show, where you're walking around and you have the people working for the car companies and they're regurgitating their well-practiced speech about their products. And living historians are the same way. You got the guy set up in front of the communication tent. He has given a speech about the field phone 475 times. And so when they come on a podcast and you talk about that stuff, it minimizes the ands, the ums, and the stuttering, because they're just regurgitating that thing that they talk about every weekend on a summer anyhow. And so it really helps to present the information in a well-rehearsed, well-polished way.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I like, in a weird... paradoxical way, I like it sometimes when a few of my guests aren't as natural and slick as some others. Because if I bring on James Holland, for example, who is just the internationally renowned historian, does his own TV, he just puts the show on. He's just Vegas in terms of his quality, and he's slick, and he doesn't even have to prep for them. It just comes out. I had Adam Tooze on, the economist who wrote Wages of Destruction, one of my favorite books about the Third Reich. He was just riffing. He was on his phone, walking around his living room, no preparation. Out of this, his head is his data coming out. And that's fantastic. But I do like having the more amateur guy who just has spent 20 years manning a website or doing living history. I used to do living history myself years ago. I gave up. And maybe they're not as polished. And I have to maybe tease a bit more out of them, and I have to be a bit more showy to kind of bring them in. But I like that, because it means people will contact me and they don't feel they have to be an experienced TV talking head to come and talk. I had an email today from someone who's a firefighter in the US who spent 20 years researching German firefighters putting out bombing. And you could sense by his email, he was a bit nervous about contacting me because he isn't Peter Caddick Adams. He's not John McManus. He's not got PhD after his name. He's not mm-hmm. lecturer at West Point or something. But I'm glad they will bother to contact me and feel that I will give them a chance. It's because some of the shows I do are not quite as slick as others, because the guest is knowledge first, interpretation skills second, if you know what I mean.
And to that point, and then I'll let Henry get in here. To that point, some of those guests that are so well rehearsed, and we've had this a few times, you pull that string and they start going, and then they hit a point you want to follow up, but they keep going and going and going. And so by the time they put that breath in, you almost got to circle the podcast back 5 minutes to get back to that point that you want to cover because they're so well rehearsed that they're just going 5 miles a minute.
And you have to get to the point where you're a little bit controlling of it.
Yeah.
And you kind of jump in and say, I'm going to interrupt you now. And Peter Caddick Adams, who's a prolific historian, will just talk. And you know, questions to him that you've got, like, it just doesn't matter. He's riffing now. Hey, and it's great.
The great Peter Caddick Adams moment was in the show After the Bulge, but where Mr. Boar came in, his dog.
Yeah.
He's out for a walk. Here he is, Mr. Boar. That was awesome. I love
And he that. Throws in these things that you're not expecting. Because Peter Caddick, I'm working class English. I wear a newsboy cap. I grew up in Essex, just outside of London. I like rockabilly music and punk music, and I'm working class all the way. Peter Caddick Adams wears tweed and red corduroy trousers and
patches
and
on his elbow,
expensive shoes from London, and he's posh. You know, he's from that part of the world, and yet he'll talk about reading on the show he did in the Ardennes Week. He was talking about reading Whitney Houston's autobiography, which I didn't see that boy coming my way.
You were like, mind blown,
because you don't think he's going to be sitting kind of with a pipe reading very learned logistical reports about the British Army in 1943, and he's actually reading a Whitney Houston book. And when he did a fellow friends of mine Fighting on Film podcast, where they discuss war movies, he did about the best oddball from Kelly's Heroes impression I've ever heard. Now, I hadn't seen that coming from Peter Caddick Adams, that he would do a woof woof. Yeah, that's my other dog
impression.
That
was brilliant, yeah.
You know.
I wouldn't have seen that coming from him either.
But it's got the point now where these guys, even the big name historians, they like coming on my channel. And this sounds like I'm really showing off and stuff. Now, Damian Lewis, that's the author Damian Lewis, not Dick Winters Damian Lewis.
Right.
You know, the first time he did a show, I was contacting him via his agent or his publicity assistant or something. And they were saying he's not going to give away all the plots of, you know, the details of his book because he doesn't want to damage his book sales. And by the third appearance, he just tells all the story because he loves it. I got an email, I think after the second show, saying he did two PR gigs the same day. One was one of those generic, he went on, you know, BBC Radio 4, and someone said, so your book is about, checks notes, the SAS in 1944. And the audience, you know, the interviewer didn't know what they were talking about, and it was 3 minutes. And then he came on with me, and he can talk, and he will say things like, thing is, you know what to ask, Woody, because you understand, you know, you understand the uniforms, you understand the units. And Sol David, who you mentioned, did the same thing. He said, you know, I like coming on because, you know, you ask cool things and the conversation will go into slightly unpredictable areas, which is cool. So I enjoy it, and it seems to be working quite well.
Yeah, I've seen that with authors in the past too. Once again, I worked in radio. And so in radio, the production house, they just want to get the name out there and get on the radio. And so the radio host will get what's called a one sheet, or have the name of the book, the name of the author, some titles, and two sentences. And it's a very stilted, very boring interview. Yeah. And so a lot of times, especially when you first start a podcast or a channel and you're trying to book these guests and they don't know about you and they don't know about your podcast, they come on expecting that whole radio format off the one sheeter. And then when you start diving in, after about a minute or two, you see them kind of relax and say, okay, I'm around someone who's like-minded and I can settle in and we can go a little deeper. And next thing you know, you're 110 minutes into it and you're like, okay, I guess we'll call it quits and we'll follow up. But it's definitely interesting to see when people come in with a kind of an expectation because they just don't know. And then you just see them kind of fall into it, which is always
fun. You know, yeah. I mean, that's a great point. It kind of seemed that way when John was on our show.
Sure.
He didn't know us from Adam. He's like, okay, guys, what do you want to talk about? And then he very quickly saw, hey man, here are three guys, which I mean, John McManus obviously knew who my father was and all that, but he very quickly realized, man, here's three guys who have a passion for World War II history. They're well-read. You know, it didn't hurt that we certainly had read a number of his books, but, and it just turned into this fantastic conversation.
Yeah, and it's good. The downside I'm getting, though, is if it's someone like John McManus who comes on who's a mate, we can go a bit informal. And I forget sometimes that people will not just watch the show live. They'll go back and watch it again. They'll put automatically generated subtitles on and they'll maybe overanalyze a sentence. It happened with a show John did where, and I forget what it was, where John said something about putting the European theater as a priority over the Pacific theater. And I would have done the same or something he said. Mm-hmm. And this viewer, the commentator said, would you really do that? Is that really John's opinion? And I was kind of trying to say, well, it was just a throwaway comment in a show.
Right.
I think John, that is John's honest opinion, but maybe he would have worded it slightly different and I would have worded it slightly different. So people will overanalyze a little bit, mm-hmm. thinking that it's a highly scripted documentary, and it's not a highly scripted documentary. It's a live show where we're talking and we're engaging and we're dealing with live comments. But on the whole, people are really good and really receptive to it. But I feel if it gets a bit bigger and people perhaps don't know who I am or don't know who the guests are, they will maybe kind of pick up things, or that was odd language you used there for that. And it's sometimes the tonal shift can be odd. You must have the same thing where you're talking about death and then suddenly something kind of humorous comes up and it's like, oh, we've got to change tone now. Like the like the radio, and you know, you play a wacky record and then you go to the news where there's been a car wreck in the town. It's, you've got to know how to kind of move that change and tonal change and then bring it back again. But if I overthink it, it probably would not work. It's just kind of go with your gut, I think, is the idea with it.
And back to that comment that the listener was picking apart. To be honest, I think at least in the living historian world, and we've actually said that same comment here, which is true. If you turn on a history channel back when it actually showed history, or you go somewhere that has a series of videos, up until the last 5 years, 89.7 of them are ETO based. You might see a North African video and a small handful of PTO. And so for the longest time, up until, you know, the Pacific came out in the last few years, most of at least the production on TV that was readily available to anybody with a cable box, it was primarily ETO. And so a lot of people do have that feeling that up until recently, that was where all the priority was. And so what he said was by no means out of balance. It's just someone tried to make it into something it's not.
Right.
But we're in a revolution now in that we are now, as consumers, assuming we can have some kind of contact with the creators.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was a kid watching World War II documentaries, you didn't think you'd ever be able to comment about why didn't you talk about this? But, you know, I get these long, sprawling, detail-laden comments where people, and I'm not sure whether they're kind of criticizing or complimenting, but they're just adding the stuff they know. They're saying, here's more shit on this, they say,
you may want, you know?
And that's fantastic. And the fact they feel they can be part of the process, and it's that kind of talent show thing, is that you feel that you're part of it because you can vote. You can vote your telephone call for your act you like. It's participation led. And I've also found, talking to authors and things, the COVID revolution is they're finding that the audience who are reading their books isn't just the people they thought were reading their books. There's a whole other demographic as well, which they're now finding, because their exposure to their audience, the Brits again particularly, was they'd go to the Chelsea Literary Festival in London, where you meet the kind of people who go to the Chelsea Literary Festival, who are people who have handmade shoes that cost 500 quid and, you know, and that's the people they were meeting. And single mums from Detroit are listening to their stuff and their podcasts as well, and that kind of thing. And they're realizing, oh, there's the people reading their books is wider than they thought. And also this connects with the fact that we're all of us. You said about history, when History Channel used to show history. if we judged what we thought people know by what conventional TV gives us, we think the world is full of idiots, because they dumb everything down to such a point that they're reminding you that, and the bad guys here, folks, are the Germans. And mm-hmm. we had these things, they were green, they were called tanks. It's that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And these brilliant talking heads go on, and they're reduced to giving sound bites because no one's allowing them to give any detail. And that's, I think, even the authors have realized, well, that must be what the viewership is like, because if that's what the big companies are making, they must know what they're doing. And then you realize with podcasts and my channel and other people's that actually there's a huge level of knowledge out there. And those people out there really know their stuff. They know their uniforms, they know their equipment, and they know their battles, and they want it to be explored in a detailed way.
It's so funny because the legacy media, they're so stuck in their ways.